So we're going to look at the lesson that's been entitled Point and Counterpoint. And as we discussed last week, and I included in the summary of what we talked about last week, we saw on our flowchart of Jewish law, of oral Torah, of the Jewish tradition, we have the received law, that which the Jews received from God at Sinai as part of the oral tradition. Then we have the derived, where certain principles were presented and then utilized and explicated by the rabbis who come to laws that are also part of the Torah. And last week we looked at the legislated, those laws which are introduced by the rabbis, either to safeguard the tradition or to sometimes facilitate a more meaningful religion, as well as the really bottom-up practices of the customs which aren't necessarily part of the rabbinical enactments, but these are things that the community did, and we talked about how those really represented a very grassroots, bottom-up embrace of God's law, or the implementation of God's law. And we talked a little about the scale, about how the received is very much weighted that God gives us, and so it is said, and so it must be done. And then the human involvement, rabbinic involvement, communal involvement of the other types of the oral tradition. So here we're going to, since we left off on the subject of the legislated, of the rabbinic rules, of the community customs, we're going to talk a little bit more about the development of those rules and regulations, as well as something which came up a little bit in Lesson 2, and we'll explore a little bit more this week and even more next week, the idea of, so where does all this machlokes come from? Machlokes, from the Hebrew word chalak, which means a portion or to divide. Ashkenazis is machlokes. In Sephardit, it's machloket. That's, if you want to know the difference, go to the Sarah Rosen's Hebrew class, and she'll fully explicate that. But how does this emerge, the idea of the different opinions, especially if some of this oral Torah is God's will, then does this mean there's a fight, there's an argument what God really wants? And how can there be an argument if it's what God really wants? And this is also one of those sort of criticisms that sometimes lobbed at the oral tradition. Well, if they can't make up their minds, or if there are two or three opinions about something, how can this really be something we have to do if there's a machlokas about it? And so we're going to start with a bit of a case study, right? To share or not to share. Page 112, text number 1. All right, with their packs full, their canteens overflowing, and their reserve bottles filled to the brim, outdoorsy Arizonans set out on foot this time of year under the scorching sun. But as they navigate the state's picturesque trails, they face not only physical challenges, but ethical ones. Like how much water to share with strangers who have miles to go and not a drop to drink. Question comes up on South Mountain, an urban refuge in southern Phoenix, on the 4-mile hike down into Fossil Springs, a couple hours north, and most definitely along the sea pathways that descend into the Grand Canyon. Wherever it is, hikers regularly encounter strangers gasping trailside from the heat. Came down to have enough for myself or helping someone, I'd have to drink my own water, said Laura Craig, a Phoenix businesswoman who shared some of her extra water with distressed strangers on a recent hike at Fossil Springs. It's an ethical decision. You hate to think of things like survival of the fittest, but it does come down to that. A hiker who had run out of water to die in the Grand Canyon last weekend after some backpackers he had encountered who were parched themselves shared some of their water with him. But the hikers continued on alone, ignoring the strangers and entreaties for him to come back toward the Colorado River, where the hikers replenished their water supplies. If giving up water would endanger myself to the point that I would also become a heat casualty, I would not share, another hiker said. Rather, I would search for help before one unfortunate hiker turned into two. This kind of situation has happened before. Shannon D. Marsak, a spokesman of the Grand Canyon National Park, said park veterans recall at least one case in which someone died trying to provide more help than they could physically afford to provide. Ms. Craig said that looking out for oneself first makes sense. It's just like an airplane when a stewardess tells you secure your own mask before you help people. It sounds selfish, but it's right. So it sounds selfish, but it's right. Do you agree?
Not exactly a perfect analogy.
Oh, so now you're employing the Talmudic razor of interpretation. Sounds selfish, but it's right. Do you agree? Raise your hand. Do you disagree? Raise your hand.
I agree that it sounds selfish, but it's right.
You disagree?
I agree.
You agree. Okay, I think, sometimes you have to make hard decisions. We can have a whole discussion of medical ethics and triage and the like. You know, is there anything wrong with people disagreeing about the answer to this question? Would it surprise you that there would be someone who disagrees with this? With your, okay, and you know, so sort of, you know, we, if that's true, then maybe it shouldn't bother us if we find a dispute about this subject in the Talmud also. Right, it's very, even if there are the majority in this room feeling one way about this question, we can easily, not easily, we can certainly appreciate that there's another side, that there would, could be others who would defend a position counter to that.
Well, there is another side. Aren't you supposed to, like, fix someone else's donkey before you fix your own? Or something?
Well, that, you know, but that's not life and death. Right, you should feed your animals before you feed yourself, but that's just, that's just being a mensch, but that's not about, if feeding the animals would lead you to die, we wouldn't tell you to do that. So, you know, if you look at the Talmudic opinions on this subject, if you see the Talmudic opinions on this subject, as we will in a minute, it's, you know, not so far-fetched. But if we regard the Talmudic sages as expressing their own views, nothing is awry about Talmudic debates. If we regard the Talmudic sages as those who teach us what God desires, well, then it could be a little bit, how can you fight over what God wants? And whichever one is right is following God's will. And those who are disagreeing, what about them? Where, you know, what do we say about that? And so, you know, does God say A or B? Which is it? In this case here, do you give your water to someone in need or not?
No. Not if you don't have enough.
Well, you know, not if you don't. You're already qualifying. One of the beauties of Jewish law, and I think we're going to see that it's part of the divine plan as well, is that things are never are not always going to be black and white. And so we're going to look at machloket. If you see on page 114 the figure there, you know, we're going to look at some of the key questions about debate. So why don't the Talmudic debates undermine the validity of the entire system of halacha? Which areas of Jewish law are subject to debate and difference of opinion? Why is there disagreement? Why would God want and or allow this? And how do we resolve debates? The last question is very simple, whatever I say. There you go. You have nothing else to worry about. But, so let's look about, you know, the Talmudic debates are often cited as evidence that Jewish law has no clarity. And the rabbinic statements are all a matter of random opinion. So if the rabbis are fighting about this particular issue, then I could do what I want also. It's not that straightforward. Might want it to be, but it's not. That doesn't work out that way. So if let's look at learning exercise number one. Right, which of the following categories of the Torah are more conducive to the existence of debate and difference of opinion? Scale of 1 to 5. 1 indicates less likely, one less debate, 5 more debate. Right, 1 is more unanimous, 5 more likely to be debated. So what do you say about received?
1.
Right? It's what God says has to be. What about the derived?
2.
Okay. What about legislated?
3.
What about customary?
4.
So no, you don't think that there's always going to be strong likelihood for debate. We're a very consensus-oriented group. You don't like debate. Okay. In general, the received oral Torah is going to be less a matter of dispute than customs. Customs, I would give it a 5. You know, you have, you know that's the story I often tell at Friday Night Live on Shabbat Across America. For the Friday night song of Lecha Dodi, there was a community that there was a dispute whether to stand or to sit. And so they decided that they would just resolve this by going to the oldest member of the community and ask the oldest member of the community who'd been there the longest what the custom is, right? You know this one. And so, you know, the standers and the sitters sent a representative with the rabbi. They're going to adjudicate. And so the standers for Lecha Dodi asked, so you've been here for 90 years, what's the custom to stand, right? And he said, no. And so the sitters get all excited. So the custom to sit. He says, no. And the rabbi says, how can it be? You stand or you sit? And the person says, well, for 90 years we've been fighting about it. So when it comes to custom, there's going to be a very likely situation of debate. But when it comes to the received tradition, no debate is possible. Text 2a, if someone will please read from Maimonides' introduction to the Mishnah. Okay, Roberta?
There are no debates at all with regard to the explanations we received from Moses. There never had arisen a debate among the sages of any era from Moses until Rav Ashi, who redacted the Talmud, in which one sage said an eye for an eye means literal retaliation, and another sage said the Torah is only referring to monetary compensation. Likewise, there never arose a dispute over the meaning of the verse. On the first day you shall take the fruit of a Hadad tree, whereby one sage said that this fruit was an etrog, and another said that it referred to a quince, a pomegranate, or some other fruit. Nor have we come across any disagreement whether anuf et avot refers to myrtle branches.
Right, this is the idea that there was never a dispute. Lulav and esrog are the objects that we take. The word etrog does not appear in the Torah. But you go all the way back to the Bar Kokhba era, and they were using, right, if you can see the image there, that's pretty much what it looks like today. The palm branch and the esrog next to it and the various branches around it. No one's ever disputed that. And Maimonides goes on to say that it would be inappropriate to think that when we talk about machloket, we're talking about, okay, should we use the orange or the citron as an esrog? Look at on the next source. 2b, it would be very strange and disgraceful for a person to think that Talmudic disagreements are about laws received from Moses, that debates ensued from forgetfulness or error, where one person's tradition was correct, but the other did not receive it properly, forgot it, or did not study sufficiently from teachers. This view is incorrect and inconsistent with the principles of Judaism. It slurs the people from whom we receive the Torah, and it amounts to empty talk. These are pretty harsh words. What brings people to believe such faulty ideas is that they are insufficiently versed in the words of Talmudic sages. They therefore fail to draw a distinction between the basic explanations that we receive from Moses and the laws that the sages derived through analysis. And I think that I have a little bit more sympathy than Maimonides, and I can appreciate it. If you ask someone why is there a dispute, people will say because things were forgotten. And I think it's natural to think that, but Maimonides is pointing out it's an uneducated approach to think that way. If we're talking about received Torah, there's no dispute. If you don't know what that is, it's because you're just not familiar. When there's dispute, it's within other realms of Jewish law, like customs. The idea that there are Talmudic statements which reference the possibility of things being forgotten, but no one ever says that they were sort of re-enacted or recast as something new. In fact, I think if you recall back in the first lesson, we talked about that part of the method of transmission was Moses would teach it, and then Aaron would teach it, and then his sons would teach it, and the sages would teach it. And before Moses died, he said, anyone have any questions? The opportunity was always there for the tradition to be reinforced. Where there's dispute, it's not in this element. It's not in the received segment of the Jewish tradition of the oral Torah. Machloket, dispute in the Talmud, over derived and legislated in customary components. Look at figure 4.2. Primary, the received, the God-given estimations for each of the commandments. There are no multiple opinions. This is the law. When it comes to the derived, which were the laws that were derived from the written Torah and the received oral Torah, sometimes, and we're going to talk about examples, because it's not going to be about the law itself, it's going to be about the derivation of the law. When it comes to legislative rules by rabbinic sages, can there be multiple opinions? Sure, there can be. They don't have to be. Sometimes, believe it or not, Jews sometimes agree. Customary things that the community introduced, can there be multiple opinions? Sure, why not? Ashkenaz, Sfar, Lithuanian, Galiciana, you name it, we have the differences. So when it comes to the received Torah, there's no dispute. What about people who say that differences of opinion are because things were forgotten? Could be, but not in the category of received. That we don't find any sort of multiple opinion. So let's talk about some of the other categories. Yes?
Do we know language they spoke to, what language?
In Sinai?
Moshe spoke?
Hebrew.
It was Hebrew.
Hebrew. Uh-huh. Spoke Hebrew. The letters did not look the same, because we have a tradition that the letters, in the time of the Assyrians, the alphabet, the way the alphabet looked, changed. So the alphabet that we're used to in today's generation, right? You know, we had it on the slide a couple weeks ago, right? Aleph, Bet, Gimel, right? That's actually called Assyrian script. Hebrew script looks very strange. Hebrew script is, you sometimes see really old sort of archaeological artifacts that don't look like Hebrew. That's Hebrew. We just now call this Hebrew, even though it's officially called in Jewish Talmudic language, Ktav Ashurit, Assyrian script. So let's talk a little bit about the derived using the sharing water. The written Torah, the received Torah, do not say anything specific. We have no biblical verse, thou shalt share thy water, or thou shalt not share thy water. What we do have is text 3a. Right? Look at text 3a from Leviticus, which has two verses. When your brother becomes destitute and his hand falters beside you, you shall support him, whether a convert or a resident, so that he can live with you. You shall not take interest from him, fear your God, and let your brother live with you. So what in this text may inform our discussion about sharing the water?
It's implicit that you yourself have to live.
Okay. You have to live. Any other thoughts based on these verses? I might want to say your brother has to live with you. So you have a responsibility to ensure his survival as much as you have a responsibility to ensure your survival. You were focusing on the chayachicha imach, that you have to live. I'll flip it around and say he has to live with you. Whatever you are living, he has to live. And in fact, when it comes, sort of to the water case, look at page 120, text 3b, Talmudic summary of this, so someone will please read. Okay, Susan?
Two people were traveling in the desert, and one of them has only a flask of water. If he drinks it, he will reach town. If both of them drink it, they will both die. Ben Turah derived that both should drink from it and die, as it says, let your brother live with you. Rabbi Akiva said to him, let your brother live with you, implying your life takes precedence over the life of another.
Well, it seemed clear that David likes Rabbi Akiva, and I'm sympathetic towards Ben Petura. Bechei Achicha Imach, with you, our lot, we're in the same boat. Rabbi Akiva, he lives with you, but your life comes first, and you don't share.
Yeah, but why can't he drink the water and carry the tablet?
Okay, these are all the issues that need to be addressed. However, we have a biblical text. We have no received tradition telling us which definition is correct. We have two rabbinic interpretations. Right? There's no...
Choose life.
Huh?
Choose life.
Okay, but that's not... There's nothing explicit in the tradition. We have one verse which can be interpreted two ways and was in fact interpreted two ways. Rabbi Akiva seems to rise to the top, right? I don't want to leave you hanging, because I don't know, maybe you'll tune out and you'll be taking a hike, one bottle of water, you won't know what to do. So the answer is, according to Jewish law, you come first. In general, according to Jewish law, you should not take risks to save someone else. You can, but you don't have to. So for example, this is an issue which is becoming more and more common, and something that in this community we become more aware of and sensitive towards. For example, kidney donation. Right, kidney donation is very straightforward. It has minimal risk. There's some risk, because if you give one kidney and your other one fails, well, you had two, you gave up one. But Judaism would not require, would not obligate you to be a kidney donor. It would say you're a very good person if you did, but doesn't obligate you. So in this situation, if you have enough water, you don't have to share the water. If you wanted to, and you wanted to take your chances and put the person on your back and carry him to safety, Yasha Koach, as we say.
Yeah, but that kind of thing is an obligation to try to get him to safety.
What do we have? Well, I think we will come back to this idea about within Jewish law the difference between obligation and the proper thing to do. I think Judaism has mitzvah, commandments, has Jewish law, and Jewish law is very vast to include the right thing to do also. But for now, here we have a situation where the written Torah and the received Torah do not provide anything specific, so the rabbis had different approaches. There's probably a reason why Rabbi Akiva is more popular than Ben Tetuah. Because it resonated with more people. I mean, think back to last week. We talked about that the rabbis cannot make rules if the people don't accept them.
But if in this particular case, it's God's rule to choose life.
That's not in this verse.
No, I know, but it's still...
And then God's rule, choose life, is not found within any commandment. It says, see, I place before you today goodness and life and evil and death. And God didn't have to tell me that. That's not a mitzvah. That's sort of just, pretty obvious. No. Interestingly enough, the mitzvah, there's a verse which says, you shall do which is right and good. Not clear that's a mitzvah either. That's an attitude. Right, there's plenty more in the Torah oral tradition which we can discuss. But for here, remember, we're trying to understand how there can be dispute.
Right.
When God tells us something that's written straight out, can't argue. If it's received, you can't argue. If you don't have a tradition, you can argue. And now let's look at some of the argument within the derived and the received tradition. Look at text number 4. Back to Maimonides. And Maimonides' introduction to the Mishnah is a text chock full of information about this. When you find Talmudic sages discussing, debating, and bringing proofs for any of the received explanations or others like it, they're not arguing over the validity or the nature of the received law, but rather how it might be derived from the biblical text. For example, the sages discuss the text which says the fruit of the Hadar tree. Right? What is the Hadar tree? Well, maybe it refers to some fruit other than the esrog. They then bring proof from the words fruit and tree to indicate that it must be fruit of a tree whose bark tastes the same as its fruit, which is true of the esrog. Another sage finds a hint for the esrog in the word hadar, explaining that the word hadar can mean to dwell, indicating that the fruit that can dwell on the tree from one year to the next, which is a characteristic of the esrog. A third sage, noting the similarity between the word hadar in the Greek, hidalor, meaning water, says this indicates this is a fruit that grows on much water, which is true of the etrog. Debates are about derivations without questioning the received law. So the fruit of a hadar tree, it's a fruit of a tree whose bark tastes the same as its fruit. Or it's a fruit that can dwell from year to year. It's a hadar fruit. Or it's hadar hador, it's one that requires a lot of water. These three opinions are not arguing over whether a fruit of a hadar tree is an etrog. They all agree that it's an etrog. The multiple opinions have to do with, how do we know that it's an etrog? And so the sages were merely investigating the biblical allusion for this received tradition. And so whichever of these you want to say makes the most sense, it's not going to change the fruit which you use on Sukkot, which is
an apple.
An etrog. It's not an apple. Now you're talking about which fruit did Adam and Eve eat. Now that's very interesting. By the way, in case you did not know, the identification of that fruit as an apple, you know who came up with that? The artist who painted that image in the first place, painted as an apple.
Who's that?
I don't remember which artist it was. Pick whichever artist painted the first known picture of Adam and Eve. The Talmud has a whole list of possibilities. Wheat, grape, esrog, not apple. In any event, we're talking where these different opinions, this is a machloket, this is not a machloket, a dispute as to what the actual law is, it's a dispute as to which potential rationale can help us understand what the received Torah is teaching. The distinction between the received and the derived can be summed up in a question Rabbi Akiva asked Rabbi Yehoshua about sacrifices. Look at text number 5 on page 122. Rabbi Akiva said, if it's a law passed down from Sinai, we will accept it. But if you are deriving it, it can be disproved. Right, so for example, if you think back to lesson number 2, we talked about the Binyan Av and the Kal V'Chomer. We talked about some of the rabbinic some of the derived, the mechanisms of derivation. And so Rabbi Akiva recognized that his teacher, Rabbi Yeshua, was a link in the train of transmission all the way back to Moshe. If Rabbi Yeshua, you can't defend the method of derivation, I can dispute the method of derivation. But if it's a law, I can't dispute that. Think back to the, like the Esrog case. The Esrog, the Hadar fruit is an Esrog. How do we know that? If you want to say the water, you want to say the fruit, you want to say one of the other explanations, we can dispute that piece.
Although he doesn't say he can just dispute it, he says he can disprove it.
If it's only about a derivation. If this is your own opinion, well, if I can logically disprove you, I'll disprove you. But if it's a law that was received, the law remains regardless. And that's what Rabbi Akiva is saying. So when we have a dispute in the Talmud about something relating to the oral Torah, if it's received, there's no dispute. If there's a received law which rabbis have suggested derivations, those derivations can be the subject of dispute, but the final law cannot be. So, you know, if you think back to a couple slides ago, the received Torah, no dispute. Derived Torah, yes, sometimes the mechanism of derivation can be the subject of dispute, but not the law itself. So there's robust debate, but not about the conclusion yet. When can we have more robust debate? When we're talking about rabbinic enactments and customs. So look at text number 6. Someone want to read on page 123? Okay, Kurt, thank you.
It is possible for there to be debate with regard to the laws that were established by the prophets and sages in each generation, when they enacted measures to protect people from violating a prohibition in the Torah. One sage might prohibit something for a particular reason, whereas another one could disagree. You find this often in the Talmud where it says, this rabbi prohibited such and such because of this and that, and another rabbi did not issue this prohibition.
Well, we saw an example of this variety with regards to last week, where after the destruction of the temple, one of the rabbis wanted to institute no smiling ever. And others disagreed, and the people didn't follow it, and therefore we're allowed to have joy, but we always have joy remembering the temple. That's why at weddings we break a glass, and there are other similar customs. So what's an example of a legislation or customary rule that we can find in some places but not in others? So one example, which is probably surprising to hear, is polygamy. Right? According to the Torah, men are allowed to have more than one wife. Abraham had Sarah and Hagar. Yaakov had Rachel and Leah. Right? You have situations of multiple wives. However, it became fairly common around the year 1000, text number 7, Rabbeinu Gershom declared excommunication upon a polygamous man, but his enactment did not take hold in all lands. All right, so here we have, Rabbi, we have the statement out of the Code of Jewish Law, recognizing that a rabbinic enactment had not been fully accepted. And nowadays, I am not familiar with any situation, any example of Jewish polygamy that is in place. But if you will ask some Jews, especially those with Yemenite ancestry, and Jews who came over from Yemen in the 20th century, in the 30s, 40s, 50s, I think if you talk to Shilo Kramer, he'll be able to share within his family that there was one of his grandfathers had two wives. It was not fully accepted. Now, as a happily married man, it makes a lot of sense to only have one wife. I can't imagine having two. But Jewish law allows for it. Rabbeinu Gershom said no, but not everyone accepted it. Now, full disclosure, this is not the best example. Because Rabbeinu Gershom never said you can't have two wives. But Rabbeinu Gershom said if you have two wives, we're going to excommunicate you. There's a difference. He's not saying you can't. He's saying if you do, you're out. There's a difference between a prohibition, which he was not able to do. Why would Rabbeinu Gershom be allowed to prohibit? Think of what we saw last week. Exactly. You're not allowed to change the Torah in any way. So this is not the best example, but it's a situation where there was a custom, a strong custom, if not an outright law, that was not fully accepted. Yes. Okay. So, and when it comes to customs, we see, can we see how long to wait between meat and dairy. Or Ashkenazim do not eat any sort of kidney or beans or legumes or rice on Pesach, and Sephardim do. And within the Sephardic community, some have rice and corn, and some don't have rice but do have corn. There are lots of different distinctions. So when we talk about the legislative customary elements of Jewish law, the sky's the limit. And sometimes, with great difficulty, I got a question from a congregant just the other day. His daughter, thank God, got engaged, and they want to get married next spring. So which dates after Passover can you not get married?
The Omer
period. But how much of the Omer period is off limits for marriage? Well, according to some opinions, right, it's the entire Omer except Lagba Omer. According to another opinion, it's the first 33 days. According to another opinion, it's only the last 33 days. So basically, when all is said and done, if you take sort of the most expansive view, you're only not getting married for like 2 weeks of the Omer. It's a sort of, you know, it highlights sort of the, you know, something what seemed to be so simple as, oh, the Omer is a sad period, so really there's only 2 weeks where you won't find any weddings. Which is very important if you're a caterer or a musician, you know, because, you know, your livelihood's at stake. Let's talk a little bit about, though, you know, what it means for there to be dispute. Yeah, you know, we spoke about with regards to the, you know, to Jewish law, there's the element of God commanding us and our obedience to God's law, as well as our role in the implementation of Jewish law. And as you move to some of the other areas beyond the received Torah, you end up with humans, rabbis, Jews, playing a role in creating the Jewish legal system. So, when we're talking about our opening question, right here, go back to, you know, when we were talking before about, you know, the saving of the life. Are there debates about facts in the Torah? No, there are no debates about the facts. When there's a tradition, we don't argue. What about, does this completely answer the question? No, the derived oral Torah is also divinely given. Right? If you think back to lesson two, those examples were not man-made examples. They were rabbinic explications of a divine system. And so we need to, you know, to think about, if the derived oral Torah is divine, then how can there be disputes? Look at text number 8. Both the written and the oral Torah are God-given. And Maimonides, in one of in his 13 Fundamentals of Faith, says the Torah, the oral Torah, the written Torah and the oral Torah are divine. So how can there be dispute? If you have one rabbi saying one thing, another rabbi saying another thing, as far as this oral Torah, which is God-given, then isn't one of them basically a heretic? Are they both right? If they're both right, then why can't I choose which one to follow? When God gave us a Torah, He intentionally embedded within it numerous questions for us to decode. The derived Torah was a human discovery of the Word of God. But how can there be a debate? Does God want us to share the water or not? How come there's no, you know, there's no guidance there? Right, if our goal is, and this is a term that we've used before in this class, to create a divine abode in this world, to sort of elevate the physical so that it's receptive to the spiritual, to elevate this world, what does God want? Well, if think back to Rabbi Akiva and Ben Keturah. So does that mean one of them is acting against God's wishes? What's going on here? So one way to look at this is that the various opinions don't start with the human mind. They start with God Himself. Ben Keturah and Rabbi Akiva were expressing to their minds which approach best expressed the divine will. And it's not about necessarily there being a question, and then you have one rabbi saying this is God's will, and that rabbi saying that is God's will. Look at text number 9a. If someone will please read on page 125. comment from the Talmud about multiple opinions. Okay, Richard?
Some sages rule that an object is ritual and pure, and others rule that it is pure. Some forbid while others permit. Some disqualify while others declare fit. A person might ask, why study Torah under such circumstances? The verse therefore says, all were given for one shepherd, one God gave them, one leader communicated them from the mouth of God, and it is written, and God spoke all these words.
Right, there's a recognition of these divergent opinions, these possibilities as being part of the divine plan from the get-go. Text 9b just reiterates the same idea. For each law that God told Moses, he would enumerate 49 arguments for ruling that an object was ritually pure, and 49 arguments for ruling that the object was ritually impure. There's the possibility of either side being right. And there's a requirement, though, for resolution. Look at text 9c. For 3 years there was a dispute between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, the former asserting the halacha is in agreement with our views, the latter contending the halacha is in agreement with our views. A heavenly voice declared, these and these are the words of the living God. Right? You're right. You're right. How can they both be right? You're right too. They're all quote-unquote right. They all originate as part of God's Torah, God's mindset for what the world should be. It becomes up to human beings to navigate between the different opinions and find a solution. How can both be correct? Look at text number 10 from Rav Yehuda Lowy of Prague. Sure.
It is not possible for anything in this world to have just one aspect to it. Even if something is ritually impure, it must contain an aspect of ritual purity. And when something is ritually pure, it must have an aspect of ritual impurity. One feature of a particular case can elicit a verdict of innocence, and another feature a verdict of guilt. One facet of a particular item or action can indicate permitted, while another facet indicates prohibited. The same applies with regard to an item or action that is either valid or invalid.
This idea of... as Rabbi Lowy continues, this idea of that there's always sort of multiple angles of everything. For me to ask the question, is this kosher or not kosher? Well, there's got to be a reason for it to be kosher. There has to be a reason for it to be not kosher. There has to be, there's no doubt for practice of practical halacha, one aspect is more important. But that doesn't mean that both elements are significant, that both elements have a certain divine origin. Everything in the world is multifaceted, and the multiple opinions reflect this. When it comes to doing, practically applying the law, one opinion has to be implemented. But that doesn't take away from the fact that this pen has a certain permitted function, a certain prohibited function. Today, permitted. Shabbat, forbidden. And the decision conveys the most dominant facet. Debate does not start in human minds. It was planned by God and starts with God. Human minds are there to discover it. Text number 11. The Torah is called a melody. The beauty of melody is when the sounds are different from each other. This is the primary pleasantness of song. Right, the process allows us to make music out of seemingly discordant notes, approaches, opinions. For the things that God specifically ruled kosher in the written and received Torah, that's kosher. Pig, nothing to talk about. Right? Cow, well, it's a kosher animal, but is it slaughtered correctly? Is it not slaughtered correctly? Right? We don't have the chance to learn about the things which are already determined in advance. But we are able to learn concerning the things for which there's no exact instructions and wish for us to derive the answers. And the engagement with Talmud study, or within the oral tradition as it's been written down, is to begin that process of differentiation. So it's not necessarily a helpful exercise to say, okay, on Shabbat I don't do X. Well, is that an area where there's dispute, or is that an area, you know, it's not as helpful, as we'll see in a minute, and we'll see even more so next week. Right, you sort of can't say, okay, so the blue Sharpie marker on a board, which can be erased very easily, is that something God said something specifically about, or is that something that the rabbis disputed? That's not a helpful exercise per se. But when studying Talmud from beginning to end, when looking through the corpus of Jewish law, when looking at Torah as a whole, it becomes something that is part of the conversation. And so multiple opinions should not be viewed as a weakness within tradition, but as God created a complex world. It's the same in many other areas. Why shouldn't it be the same within the implementation of Jewish law? And as Rabbi Epstein concludes, one who swims in the sea of Talmud will find pleasure in each of its differing sounds. There's a dispute? Good. Explore it. Examine it. Figure out what the conclusion is. Why is there a dispute? Yes?
So, I mean, God says this, says all of this explicitly, does he not, when he commands us to create a court system?
Okay, and I think that we're going to see some of that in a moment, because, you know, when God embedded in his Torah different possible ways to understand something, there were different possible outcomes. All these outcomes are true because they all teach us something about the matter under discussion. The world is complex. Each derived halachic opinion reflects a particular characteristic of the case under discussion. Think of Rabbi Akiva and Ben Petura, do you save a life or who comes first? And it's only through hearing the viewpoints that we can learn about the overall case. The decision, right, the halachic conclusion, reflects the most important and dominant feature of that case. So, as to your question, what about reaching a ruling? How do you reach a ruling? Well, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses wondered the same thing. Look at text number 12. For each law that God told Moses, we looked at part of this before, he would enumerate 49 arguments for ruling that an object was ritually pure, and 49 arguments for ruling that the object was ritually impure. So if you have 49 reasons yes, 49 reasons no, what do you follow? Moses said before, Master of the Universe, how will we be able to reach a practical decision? God responded, follow the majority. If the majority rules it's ritually impure, it is impure. If the majority rules pure, it is pure. That is the role of David, as you mentioned. That was the Sanhedrin. That was the role for the rabbinic court. And it's further mentioned in text number 13. As long as the Sanhedrin was in existence, there was no enduring halachic debates among the Jewish people. A Jew who had a doubt about a particular law would inquire of the local Beit Din. If the judges knew the answer, they would tell him. If not, the questioner would go together with the Beit Din or its representatives to Jerusalem and ask the Beit Din that sat on the Temple Mount. If his judges knew the answer, they would tell him. If not, they would all go to the Beit Din that sat by the entrance to the temple courtyard. If his judges knew the answer, they would tell them. If not, they would all go to the chamber of hewn stone where the Sanhedrin convened. If the Sanhedrin knew the answer because it had received tradition about it or because it had derived it, it would say so immediately. If the answer was not immediately clear to the Sanhedrin, its members would discuss it until everyone agreed, or they would put it to a vote and the law would follow the majority. But once the Sanhedrin ceased to exist, divergent opinions proliferated. One sage would rule that an article is ritually impure and support this ruling with a rationale. Another would rule that it is pure and support this ruling with a rationale. One would rule an article is forbidden, and another that it is permitted. Right? That there was, you know, as Maimonides sets up, there was a whole system of, you have a question, you go to the rabbi, you go to the next rabbi, you keep appealing until you get to the Supreme Court. And what do you do? Well, you follow the majority. Right? If all or most of the Jewish sages would agree, it would become binding, just like an act of the Sanhedrin. Well, what do we do today? Well, here is where Maimonides sort of summarizes something that we mentioned last week. Text number 14. It is incumbent upon all Jews to follow all the rulings recorded in the Babylonian Talmud. Each city and each province must follow the customs endorsed by the Talmud and must enforce all rabbinic legislation mentioned therein. And this is because the Jewish people agree to all of these rulings and because all the Jewish sages, or at least a majority of them, issued those decrees and edicts, endorsed those customs, derived those new applications, and handed down those final halachic rulings. Maimonides points out that what we see in the Talmud, well, the Jews accepted it. You want to disagree, you're upset that they did so, too bad. There's no way of sort of rolling back history. This is what we've now has become accepted. Remember, we spoke about last week, the rabbis can't make rules that people don't practice. But what's in the Talmud, and what emerges from the Talmud, is what people were practicing. Also, the majority had spoken. All of the majority, whether it be the Sanhedrin, if not the Sanhedrin, then the majority of the sages who had been collected, who had been active in this time of the Talmud, had a chance to speak. So the majority of the sages agreed to with what the Talmud says. And it was accepted by the majority of Jews that this is the practice. What about what possibility for a debate exists today? Well, things that are not finalized by the Talmud. Yes?
That's why Brooklyn brought up a lot of things Saturday. The first class Saturday, he brought up a lot of things.
Correct. No, he certainly did. And I think that, you know, so Susan's referring to over Shavuot, we heard from a rabbi named Rabbi Brody who talked about certain issues relating to Shabbat. And how do we understand... How do we understand the permissibility or the non-permissibility of certain things? So that's where we can have a discussion.
But he was very good because he made himself clear that the middle button for the electric is good for hospitals.
Right. So what one area in particular that was a subject of discussion was sort of, is it in the spirit of Shabbos? Let's say nowadays technology can afford us the opportunity to create things that would let us do things on Shabbat that would normally be prohibited.
Yeah.
Leaving aside the specifics, because it's a little bit complicated, but there are things, there are ways to avoid violating the letter of the law.
Right.
But is that still good? Well, we can have a discussion. The Talmud didn't decide one way or the other, so we have to have that discussion, determine which are the principles, which are the variables which will help us make our decision in this case. So when we're talking about the Talmud, we're talking about, as Maimonides says, rabbinic law. Well, we used to have a Sanhedrin. Well, when the Sanhedrin stopped, we have a Talmud. That Talmud reflects the thinking of the majority of the sages, and we know that the rule in Judaism when it comes to dispute, who do we follow? The majority. And the rules of the Talmud were accepted by the people, so they are legitimate rabbinic rules. So therefore, accepted by the people, it's the majority, we're not going to change. Right, I think I have mentioned before that one of the things I feel will never happen within Orthodoxy is egalitarianism. Women in the Orthodox community will not count as a quorum. And that could bother some people. But you know, as I said before, one way to do it is if you want to have a service that won't start without 10 men and 10 women, there's no reason why you can't introduce that policy. But you can't have 8 men and 2 women or 2 women and 2 men and 8 women. That's not going to happen in Orthodoxy because the Talmud... closed, and the decision was 10 men make a minion. There were a couple of hands up. Yeah, Richard.
The reform and conservative branch.
Right.
Would that be able to, of course...
No, I would say reform is very different, because reform basically said Judaism, the laws are a choice. They said Sinai was where Judaism was introduced to the world, and we were there to add to the world, but they felt that Jewish law was not a binding, eternal responsibility. In Reform Judaism, rituals and rituals and mitzvot are options, not obligations. Conservative Judaism had a more flexible cutoff point and feels that things which are part of the derived, or certainly things which are part of the legislated Torah, are more flexible for reinterpretation. Possibly derived too, but we can't go into the specifics. But conservative Judaism is halachic. They just feel that it is more flexibility. Any other hands? Okay. So, what's left for us to debate? Well, a lot of, you know, some of the particulars of Jewish law, which are not specifically addressed. So, you certainly have in the realm of technology, certainly in the realm of morals and ethics, certainly in the realm of, you know, certain situations which exist today that didn't exist once upon a time. And especially in areas where the Talmud is not explicit, even if Jewish law continued in a certain direction, there may be more flexibility for other types of approaches. So one example, which I think would fall into this category, is that the Talmud has a statement that women, that a woman's voice is seductive, and men should avoid listening to a woman's voice. However, that is sort of how several statements in the Talmud were interpreted and introduced in Jewish law. But if you re-examine those statements, they never said, doesn't say there, men can't listen to women sing. And so we have the ability to look at those Talmudic texts and to try and understand what they're speaking about specifically. And it could be that just because a certain halakhic tradition says men don't listen to women sing, period, that doesn't have to be the end of the discussion. In some communities it is, in some communities it isn't.
That's a custom.
I'm not saying it's a custom. I'm saying that it's an area, subject that is addressed in the Talmud, but the way it's implemented in Jewish law is has become more widespread in terms of its implementation in Jewish law is not the be-all, end-all. Because you have sages in the 17th century saying, yeah, this is a true. You shouldn't listen to women singing provocative, sexually explicit types of songs that sort of are there to entice or seduce men. But I would say that in many areas of Jewish law or many Orthodox circles, it's no listening to women sing, period. That's legitimate, but I don't think it's exclusive, and it's because the Talmud doesn't say no listening to women sing.
It's also a question of whether it applies to recorded music.
Okay, correct. There are a lot of open questions because of that, right? David said, what about recorded music? They didn't have recorded music then, so there are those who feel recorded music's not part of this prohibition. But some say, but if you know what the woman sings like, and when you might visualize her while listening to recorded music, then it's no good. And you can see where this is going. But when it's in the Talmud, the majority of the sages had a chance to speak and spoke, and the people were accepting. Makes it harder to roll back. Orthodoxy doesn't roll it back. Reform, very different. Conservative, more flexible in its in what it rolls back. And so if we're talking about, the Talmud has the authority to choose one opinion over another. This is binding because the Talmud constitutes the majority. And this is sort of I would say, Richard, in answer to your question before, this sort of is the distinction between Orthodox and conservative. Conservative Judaism does not embrace this fully.
Talmud.
Well, the fact that the Talmud constitutes majority, you can't change it. Yeah, so a debate that's not resolved in the Talmud can remain a debate. So debate today, rabbis debate the meaning of a Talmudic ruling. If it's not explicit, like the Kol Isha, the women's voice example I gave before. Yeah. Or the question only arose after the Talmud was completed, Shabbos switch.
Yeah.
Or the Talmud led a debate stand without resolving it, which we encounter. Now, I'll take your question into just one more comment, Susan. There are those who feel that Judaism treats the code of Jewish law the same way it does the Talmud. Right? The idea of Shulchan Aruch, written by Rabbi Yosef Karo, we've referenced that before, is sort of the standard bearer in terms of Jewish law today. And so there are those who feel that the code of Jewish law is as binding, incumbent upon us to follow as the Talmud. And I think I may have mentioned this last week, that the law codes in many ways sort of froze the ability of sort of having more debate. If you sort of say, if something is not clear in the Talmud, but the code of Jewish law does seem to clarify it, if the code of Jewish law is as binding as the Talmud, well, that's another layer of ossification of Jewish law not being flexible anymore. And as I mentioned last week, Code of Jewish Law, as a positive for the Jewish community, was not so clear when it first came out. Code of Jewish Law came out in the 16th century. There are many who opposed it, saying that what this is doing is sort of closing the discussion on many topics which should not be closed. In general, law codes, instruction books, make it much more direct, which leaving much less room for further discussion, because you just follow step one, step two, step three. Code of Jewish Law is as its name suggests. This is what you do. If this is what you do, you're not going to dispute to do it any way differently, even if such possibility or flexibility does exist. So it's just sort of a caveat that debate today is not really as open as this suggests, because the Code of Jewish Law really has become a new template for our observance. We have to sort of talk about it. This is more will come next week. Does this mean that once the Sanhedrin ruled that it's case closed forever? Is there ever an opportunity for change? We're going to see that next week. Yes?
Who are the witnesses
Well, so you know, we need a course on denominations, yeah. Maybe, and maybe we'll offer one. But Reconstructionist Judaism emerged out of the thinking of Mordechai Kaplan. Mordechai Kaplan was someone who began his career as an Orthodox rabbi. Actually, began his career as rabbi of KJ, and then moved on to the Jewish Center. He was the founding rabbi of the Jewish Center, and he was. This is the turn of the 20th century when there was much less difference between Orthodoxy and conservative Judaism, at least modern Orthodoxy. He looked at Judaism's main role as being that of a civilization. The rituals of Judaism that are maintained are some of the rituals that keep us distinct. Not because we have to practice them, but you can't have Judaism without kosher. You can't have Judaism without Shabbos. Now, one's loyalty and commitment to them is not because they're obligated, but this is what has kept Jews unique. He's a very interesting thinker, Mordechai Kaplan. He had a lot of things right in the 20th century, but I think that one of the things which makes Judaism unique is that we are a people of command. We are commanded. Now, you can say, I'm going to disobey the command, and that is what often happens with those who are not observant. They're observant all the time, but everyone disobeys a command. But to say we are not a people of command, you loosen the bonds that connect the people to Judaism. Right? I think that that's sort of the major challenge. If you look at the segments of the Jewish community which are growing, it's those segments which recognize that we are people of command. I go in with eyes wide open. I know that not every single member of my Orthodox synagogue behaves in Orthodox fashion all the time. But I'm imagining that the reason why they're members of an Orthodox synagogue is because they believe in the type of Judaism we present and promote, and that's what keeps this community vibrant and keeps Orthodoxy in general growing. When you don't accept the whole system, then your chances of survival as a community are much more, much greatly diminished. So, with regard, just one last note. With regards to this dispute, if you look at text number 15, God found no better vessel than peace to holding blessing for the Jewish people. For it says, the Lord shall grant strength to his people, the Lord shall bless his people with peace. So, what about all this machloket? What about all this dispute? And so I think we have to sort of recognize that what we're trying to create is a unity from diversity. You can't have peace unless you have opposites. You only make peace when you have multiple views, that you have to learn to coexist with each other. When members of the minority would join the majority, true peace dawned upon the Jewish people. The idea that you had a school of Shammai and a school of Hillel, and you had the Talmud, you had the sages, the majority say, this is the opinion, and that becomes the method of observance for the entire community, that's peace. The idea, and so on some level, peace, the idea of shalom, the blessing of shalom, which is such an important blessing, is very much in sync with this idea of there being diversity. Because what true diversity or difference of opinion within the Talmud is meant to create a more unified and uniform approach to Jewish law. One of the things which we don't have today is that ability to sort of create a common sense of this is what all Jews want to believe. Rabbi Jeremy Weider, who's the scholar in residence here at KJ, his spin on the differences between Shammai and Hillel is that whatever differences the two academies had, they still ate in each other's homes and married each other's children. Which means whatever differences of opinion may have impacted their rules of kosher, they still ate in each other's homes and recognize the Jewish status of each other's children, even if there was reason, there were certain differences which are more technical and I'm not going to go into now. He says that in the Orthodox community or the Jewish community, if we can have recognized that this is kosher and this is who is a Jew, he says, well, you add on to pray in each other's synagogues, that's a good type of uniformity to have. Right? Orthodoxy and conservative reform will never agree. But within the Orthodox community, if we can eat in each other's homes and marry each other's children and pray in each other's shuls, we can have a certain type of unity which comes from diversity. Next week we will look at the more things change and dig a little bit more deeply into some of the things not resolved in the Talmud and the types of machloket, challenges and disputes within Jewish law that we have today. Next week, back on Monday night, 7 o'clock, right here.